I want to talk a little bit about a aspect that's, I think, very important in terms of crop production, and that is looking at the crop-weed interactions. In reality, in nature, there is no such thing as a weed. We define a weed basically as the amount of damage that it does to a crop, and that damage is considerable. Globally, we recognize that weeds represent the greatest biotic constraint to crop yield. That constraint is roughly around 50% on a global basis. So even within the United States, where we use herbicides to control weeds, we still, based on Weed Science Society estimates, get about a 10% loss of production, even with herbicide application. If we use best management practices but no herbicide application, that goes up to about 25%. And in fact, if we don't use any control for weeds at all, you simply get 100% loss of crop. Globally, weeds are the greatest biotic constraint to crop production, and that's, I think, particularly true for developing countries. So how climate change impacts that is going to be important, and there are a couple of very sort of broad characteristics of climate change. The abiotic characteristic, the change in physical constraints, temperatures, temperature variation, precipitation, and many of the previous speakers have touched on that. I want to spend a little bit of time, however, really focusing on the biotic aspect of that, and that's the fact that the increase in CO2 represents an increase in a basic resource, one of the four basic resources that plants need in order to grow, the others being nutrients, water, and sunlight. So we know that about 90 to 95% of all plant species lack optimal amounts of carbon dioxide, and as that changes, then we can expect to see variation in the response between crops and weeds. When I began doing weed research that many years ago, one of the major works that we had at that time, or the major paradigm at that time, was that CO2 is plant food and that will mean fewer weeds in agriculture. And the reason why that was the paradigm is really based on a seminal work by Leroy Holm and others called The World's Worst Weeds. And if you were a weed nerd at that time in college, you carried it around with you along with your slide rule. And it really was a very important analysis. It was the first systematic attempt to evaluate globally significant weed problems in agriculture. That is, they looked at various crop systems throughout the world, and they identified what they considered to be the worst weeds, that is, the weeds that resulted in the greatest amount of crop loss. It was based on weed scientists from 100 different countries, and it basically resulted in this paradigm that the crops and weeds can be divided by photosynthetic pathway. That is, many of the most important crops were C3 photosynthesis, many of the worst weeds were C4. And I think historically that's probably because some of the first papers that came out on C4 photosynthesis did so, I think, in the late 1960s. And during the time that all this information was accumulated, it was becoming more and more relevant. And so I think many of the scientists at that time sort of were really interested in that photosynthetic pathway. And this was a way to use that different photosynthetic pathway as a way of categorizing crops and weeds. And most of you know, of course, that for C4 photosynthesis, you have this concentrating pump that keeps the CO2 concentration around Rubisco high. As a result of that, there's less photorespiration, less carbon loss. In contrast, for C3 photosynthesis, there is no mechanism to recover any of that lost CO2 through photorespiration. And visually, you see it on the right, where a C4 plant like Soteria viridis or green foxtail will increase in terms of growth up to a certain amount of CO2. Bryce, however, as a C3 plant, will keep on increasing in terms of overall plant growth. We'll ignore the fact that Soteria and rice don't actually compete with each other, but we'll move on. So when you looked at some of the early studies that were done and looking at the biotic impact of rising CO2, many of those studies really focused on C3 crops and C4 weeds. And often, of course, the overall result of that was that CO2 was favoring the crop in a number of different instances. And so this really became the paradigm. When you rose CO2, then we expected to see that weeds are less responsive to CO2 than crops, and weed competition will decline, as will crop losses, as a result of that increase in CO2. There's a problem, however, with paradigms. They change. If you actually go back to Leroy Holmes' work in 1977, and you look at, for North America, the three major crops, corn, soybean, and wheat, and now look at those same three crops for what the worst weeds are, and what I've tried to do here is to outline any differences between 1977 and today in yellow, what you find is that in almost all the cases, what was a worst weed back in the 1970s is no longer considered a worst weed today. And often you find that in the case of the paradigm of having a C3 crop versus C4 weeds, for soybean, for example, in 1977, that's no longer true today. Many of the worst weeds in soybean are, in fact, have C3 photosynthesis. So when you give it a more broader view, what you find is that worst changes with time. And that's perhaps not surprising. Management changes with time. Environment changes with time. Lots of things change with time. So in reality, if you do a more broader overview, what you find is that C3 and C4 crops compete with C3 and C4 weeds. And on average, a given crop competes with 8 to 10 weeds. And if you go beyond that sort of simple analysis of a C3 crop, C4 weed, what you find is that in those cases where a C4 crop is competing with a C4 weed or a C3 crop is competing with a C3 weed, in fact, it's the weed that is the winner in this case, that they are able to outcompete the crop once you give them additional carbon dioxide. And you can also go back to that original paradigm of C3 crops and C4 weed and do what I call CO2 plus experiments, CO2 plus temperature, in which case the weed, C4 weed, is still outcompeting, CO2 plus drought, in which case the C4 weed is still the better competitor, CO2 plus nitrogen deficit, and again, the C4 weed wins. So I'm going to offer today at this meeting my own new paradigm, and that is that often the worst weed may be a wild, weedy relative of the crop. So in the case of cereals, for example, wild oat might be the worst weed. In the case of sorghum, shatter cane might be the worst weed. In the case of rice, red rice or weedy rice might be the worst weed. And there is actually some quantitative evidence to support that. Why would we consider them worse? Well, because these are, in fact, weeds that are already pre-adapted to the physical conditions that are optimal for your crop. Why not? They're the same genus and species often as the crop itself. And there's another reason, and that is they're difficult to identify. One of the first lines of defense the farmer has for weed control is being able to recognize that the weed is different than the crop. But if you have a wild rice plant growing with cultivated rice, it's very difficult to distinguish between the two. So when you actually look at data from rice yield loss from season-long weed interference, what you find is that those weeds that are basically adapted to those same conditions in which the rice is grown, in this case red rice and barnyard grass, that's where you in fact experience the greatest amount of yield loss. So I want to focus a little bit on that particular system, that is cultivated rice and wild or weedy rice. And now let's go back and ask the question, what happens when I add more CO2 to this worst weed situation? Now, if I look at monocultures of Clearfield, which is a cultivated rice line, and Stuttgart, which is the wild or weedy red rice line, what I find is that, in fact, going from 300, the CO2 concentration at the beginning of the 20th century, to 400, the CO2 concentration today, and 500 sometime in the next 30 years, the Clearfield shows a bit of a response, but in fact, the amount of seed yield for Stuttgart doubles. If I do it in competition, where I put in 8 weedy rice plants per square meter and 16 weedy rice plants per square meter, and I look at the relative ratio of seed production from the weed to the crop, lo and behold, in fact, it's the weed that responds much more than the crop does, becomes much more competitive, and has a greater degree of fitness by producing so much more seed. So I would argue that weeds, especially the worst weeds, given the definition I've given you, are more likely to respond to a resource change like carbon dioxide than the crop. And as such, crop losses are likely to increase, not decrease, with increasing CO2, the exact antithesis of what the paradigm was when I began doing weed research. There's more. One of the questions I get when I point this out is, well, you know, Dr. Zuska, we have, you know, these chemicals that you can actually spray and that are used to control weeds. Will this really be a problem? Fair enough. Well, we didn't choose Clearfield just by accident. Clearfield, in fact, is it's a chemical mutant that's designed to be sprayed with herbicide because it's resistant to that herbicide, and it's often used in cases where red rice has infested the rice field. So what we did is we planted Clearfield with Stuttgart red rice at a ratio of 7:1, roughly around 3 to 4 plants per square meter, for three CO2 concentrations, 300, 400, and 600 parts per million. Again, the beginning of the 20th century, the current level, and the IPCC 21st century prediction. We did this in growth chambers at Beltsville. And then we took the resultant seed from that, and we planted it in Arkansas. And the maybe a little bit difficult to see in the pictures, but the light green that you see in the background is actually weedy or red rice. And there's considerably more of it under 600 parts per million than there is under 300 parts per million. And our question then, we know that Clearfield rice crosses at low rates with red rice, and that any herbicide-resistant hybrids could be confirmed using DNA fingerprinting. And our question was, did rising CO2 influence the rate of outcrossing of gene flow between the wild and the cultivated line? So this is the percent outcrossing and outcrosses per plot for the pollen donor as detected and cultivated in wild rice populations in the field plots that I just showed you. And in the case of Stuttgart, which is the STGS, the weedy or wild line, versus Clearfield, the cultivated line, there was a lot more gene flow coming from the weedy red rice line to the Clearfield line, and that was very much a function of increasing CO2. Now, why is that? What was going on? Well, in part, the reason that outcrossing rates are low between red rice and cultivated rice is that there's a lag time in flowering. That is, typically you find that red rice flowers anywhere from 7 to 8 days behind the cultivated rice. But when you gave more CO2, what we found was that that lag time went to only a couple of days, and so there was a lot more outcrossing going on. And the direction of outcrossing was always from wild to the cultivated population, and this resulted in what we call a de-domestication of the cultivated line. That is, the cultivated line was no longer cultivated. It reverted back to its wild characteristics. Those wild characteristics include shattering, but they also include, ta-da, more herbicide resistance. They had taken that from the cultivated Clearfield line. Why the difference in response? Well, we did a comparison of wild and cultivated lines a few years ago. This is work that was done with Anna McClung at the USDA Rice Lab. And we looked at a number of different parameters of leaf area versus biomass, but you can do it for any two parameters you care to examine. And we did it for the cultivated rice lines, which are the open circles, and the wild or weedy rice, which is the closed circles, at 300 and 400. And remember, this is the change in CO2 that's already occurred. And what we found at 300 parts per million is that there was a lot of overlap. There wasn't much difference in terms of how the plants responded in terms of growth. But when we increased the carbon dioxide, suddenly we started seeing segregation. It was the weedy lines that were able to better respond. They were better able to utilize this additional resource. And if you look at it in terms of seed yield, again, Clearfield and Stuttgart going from 300 to 400 parts per million, it is, in fact, the Stuttgart, the weedy rice line, that's able to show a very dramatic increase in terms of overall seed yield. And what we would argue is that there are basically two different processes that are going on here. One is artificial selection by breeders. Now, breeders are going to, what are breeders going to choose for? Well, they're going to choose for things like disease resistance. They're going to choose for things like seed quality, very useful things to have. But natural selection is going to choose for those lines that can best utilize that additional resource, i.e. CO2, and convert that into seed yield in order to increase their overall evolutionary fitness. Now, that's not to say that, of course, that cannot occur in natural lines as well, and that's looking at that breeding figure on the left. Remember, in breeding, you start with background genetics. That is, there are tens of thousands of different Oryza sativas of rice that are out there, but very few of them necessarily have the characteristics that breeders are looking for. So you have this bottleneck in which you're going to select from a very large amount of genetics to get a very narrow amount of genetics. I call this the McDonaldization of breeding. How many of you eat at McDonald's? You're among friends. It's okay. I like their fries. I mean, I don't know if you guys like their fries. I like their fries. But here's the thing. If you go to Idaho and look at the variation in the amount of potatoes that are being grown, you'll find that 95% of all the potatoes grown in Idaho and many other states are russet Burbank potatoes, because that's what McDonald's buys. There's a very strong economic incentive to do that. But the problem is that by having a very narrow genetic base that may, you know, very strong economic reasons for having that, but having that narrow genetic base and you're changing the environment versus having a large background of wild lines to choose from, you're going to be likely to find that the fitness, the better fitness among the greater genetic variation that is inherent in the wild lines. And let me give you an example of this in the graph on the right. Now, this is seed yield in grams per plant. 4484, Clearfield 161, and M204 are all cultivated rice lines. And we looked at ambient, which is the solid line here, open circles, and elevated CO2, with the dashed line, closed circles, under three different day-night temperatures, 29, 21, through 33, 25. And as Dr. Booty mentioned, as you increase temperature, yield tends to go down. But what's interesting about that is that among all of the different temperatures that we looked at, it was the Stuttgart, the wheaty rice line, that was able to respond to CO2 in all of those conditions. It was the wheaty rice line that was still able to utilize CO2 as a resource and to produce more seed yield. Can our worst weeds, in fact, be our best hope for adapting crops to climate change? How are weeds adapting? What are the mechanisms there? What would we tell breeders in terms of how weeds are responding and to give them information that they begin to use in weeding in any kind of breeding programs? I know this is a busy slide. I apologize. Often as an academic, you have to sign a paper that says you have at least one really complex slide that nobody in the back can read. So this is my contribution to that. But basically what this slide shows is that for the four different lines that I was talking about earlier, for the three different temperatures, 29, 21 through 33, 25, this is tiller number beginning at about 10 days through about 6 weeks. And in every case where we saw an increase in seed yield, we also saw this flexibility with respect to tiller. And in the case of the Stuttgart S, which is on the far right, in fact, it had this ability to produce tillers in all of these different temperatures with more CO2. And I should explain a little bit. If you look at the history of breeding, one of the things that happened during the Green Revolution was that many of the Green Revolution lines, many of the semi-dwarfs that came out from the Green Revolution, had this increase. They had a lot of tillering capacity, plasticity. But the problem was that many of those tillers, those stems, did not produce a panicle. They didn't produce seed. So breeders went, aha, we don't want that. We're going to produce a line that has few tillers, but has big panicles, and we'll plant them closer together in order to maximize yield. But the difference is that when you give that idiotype more CO2, you don't really see a big change in terms of growth or seed yield. On the other hand, if you have these lines that have this tillering capacity, when I give them more CO2, what happens is those tillers, which had not been productive before, suddenly start producing panicles. So we think that's one of the things that we should try to look for. And if you look at this variation in tillering between 600 parts per million and 400 parts per million among the different lines that are here, relative to the seed yield increase where zero is no effect, 0.4 is a 40% increase, and so on, there's a pretty good correlation there. So we think this is an initial step to begin any sort of breeding varieties. And there is some work that's undergoing right now in Japan where they're beginning this sort of pre-screening to look at potential rice lines that could, in fact, better adapt it to rising CO2 based on this tillering response. Now, we've expanded this tillering response to look at wheat, and we didn't see as good a correlation there. This was an experiment done just recently at Beltsville by my colleague Jim Bunce, based on lines that he received from Simmet. But what he found was that while there wasn't a good correlation with respect to tillering, there was a very good correlation with respect to plasticity in seeds per head. Very good. So the ability to take that additional CO2 and produce more seeds per head was, in fact, a very strong characteristic associated with the ability to convert more CO2 into more seed yield. So there are opportunities. Again, there are opportunities to take what weeds are doing, the wild relatives of these crops, and to use it as a means to learn how to adapt crops, particularly cereals, to climate change and rising CO2. So let me explain. No, there's no time. Let me sum up. There is no basis for assuming that as CO2 rises or as climate changes, that weeds will be less of a threat for crop production based on photosynthetic pathway. While it's tempting to think that, in fact, the data do not really back that up. Preliminary evidence suggests that weeds may, in fact, impose a greater limitation on crop production. The worst weeds, often the wild relative of the crop, may be better able to adapt to the increase in CO2 and or temperature associated with future conditions. This may include, but is not limited to, increased gene transfer from wild to cultivated lines and increased herbicide resistance as a result of that. However, adaptation among wild weedy lines may serve as a means to enhance adaptation of cultivated lines, especially cereal lines, to increase production as CO2 increases. So, thank you very much. You're talking about the slope of the curve with respect to temperature, that it went down more? Yes. However, in terms of the relative response to CO2, it was still greater. I think one of the issues with respect to looking at flowering is not, I think you put it as fight versus flight, which I thought was a very good way of interpreting it. One of the characteristics, temporal characteristics of weeds, of weedy rice, is that they can flower at different times than during the afternoon. They sometimes flower at night, they sometimes flower during the morning. And that may be a way to avoid that high temperature stress. In the case of, I have to go back and look, but in the case of Clearfield, I think they do it more during the middle part of the day and their temperature sensitivity may be greater. But other weedy lines that we've looked at, there is a change in terms of when they flower, more so than in the cultivated lines.
Yeah.
Well, the quality issue is one of a host of issues that have to be faced by breeders. I mean, you can't just sell weedy rice on the open market. You have to have the qualities of pest resistance, disease resistance, quality, et cetera. That being said, we think that if we can identify these kinds of genetic or morphological markers that can be used as a potential part of a breeding program going forward, then there might be some benefit for that. One of the pushbacks I get from breeders is, well, we're already doing this because we're selecting for the best yields, and therefore we must be selecting for the most CO2 responsive cultivars over time. And the problem with that is that if you actually go back in time and look at and compare cultivars that were released, say, in the 1920s and the 1950s and today, just the opposite is true. The ones that were released in the 1920s and the 1950s and later are, in fact, the most CO2 sensitive cultivars. The issue of quantity is, of course, of importance, but the issue of quality, particularly the ubiquitous effect that many of you are aware, that as you increase CO2, you're decreasing protein, is an issue that we haven't faced yet, but it's one that we need to look at more closely. Thank you, Sue. Thank you very much.